I'm Colin Grant, and delighted you're all here today for a kind of celebration of Malcolm X, who would have been 100 had he lived. As you know, he was born in 1925. He was a spokesman for the Nation of Islam, and he was assassinated in 1965. He was a canny communicator, and as we speak, we're going to be seeing a slideshow of some of those images that capture him at his best. A lot of the images are taken by the photographer Eve Arnold, who was on the road with him in the 1960s as he campaigned to get more people and funds for his organization. So in a way, Malcolm X, I don't know if you ever watched him give any speeches to his followers. Sometimes he was like a pastor giving a sermon, and it called to mind why I should maybe ask you to do something that he would do with his audience. Because you've come here sometimes by yourself, you're alone, but you're not at home. You've made a decision to be in an environment with other people. We have a communion here. So what I'd like you to do, first of all, is turn to your left and to your right, to your neighbor, and say, peace be with you.
Clementine.
Peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Right, okay.
Peace be with you.
Well, that's the quietest peace be with you I've ever heard. So maybe it's a product of being in Edinburgh. I'm joined today by Eko Ushun, who's a writer, broadcaster, and curator. He's partly responsible why we're here. He's written this fantastic book called The Strangers. There are five characters that he's focused on, one of whom is Malcolm X. And beside Eko, we have Vayu Naidu, who is a storyteller and a Royal Literary Fund Fellow. Congratulations. And her latest book is called The Living Legend, Ramayana Tales from Far and Near. That's Vayu. And beside Vayu, we have Clementine Burnley, who is a poet, writer, and shaman, I learn. And she also runs a Royal Literary Fund Reading Round group. And her latest collection is called Radical Pairings, a collection of poems, which is a fantastic collection. I've got two copies on my shelves. That's how good it is. Mm. Sadly, Bonnie Greer couldn't be with us here today, but she has this to say about Malcolm X. Now, Malcolm's a kind of saint, and that's okay because sometimes sainthood is necessary before people begin to hear and to think and to feel. He was no saint, nor a prophet, not to me. To me, he had enormous courage, a great heart, and he was a seeker. Like Martin Luther King and the civil rights activist Medgar Evers, Malcolm became one of the three M's who James Baldwin revered. He did not live long enough to become the has-been that my fellow black boomers rendered James Baldwin. So if you stick along now, you're known as a has-been, by the way. So. Watch out for that. We did not have to cancel Malcolm like we did Martin Luther King before his assassination. So they are. She's kind of implying that had Malcolm X survived, he wouldn't have been as polemical enough for some of the people who admired him, and he might have been canceled. But let's start off by asking the panel, when they first read the autobiography or encountered Malcolm X. When did Malcolm X loom in your mind, Eko?
I mean, I think in the most in the larger sense of that, going back to the 1980s, it was a kind of interesting resurgence in popular culture, in hip hop, in music and style, in I suppose the mid to late 80s, around black nationalism, pan-Africanism in America and the UK, kids going around with like Africa pendants. It's a Spike Lee film, Malcolm X. So I was introduced to him primarily through music. Mm-hmm. Like I knew of Malcolm X, but I think what was apparent at that time was the capacity for the idea and the presence of Malcolm X to go beyond the words themselves. Mm. And I saw it most significantly at that point in time.
Thanks, Eko. How about you, Vayu? I know you have an interesting tale to tell about your first encounter with Malcolm X.
Yeah, it's a sort of monumental and historic, and you know, the opportunity to write about it has been very significant for me. It happened in 1969. I was in a state-funded school in Washington, D.C. I'm the first black-led head teacher. I mean, it was a black head teacher. This is straight after the civil rights. So there was a whole policy shift, and I was coming from India. Okay, I had English language. I didn't really know anything about American culture other than possibly white American culture. But Malcolm X absolutely opened the lid on race, on seeing oneself. And I'll only say this at the moment. It was comical because a lot of us Indian young teenagers used to try to straighten our hair for the frizz factor. And that is such an important... And I remember in school they were actually having a musical production of Hair and reading the autobiography as a young girl, seeing what he was trying. And, of course, the whole politics of straightening hair to look like, you know, the white host community. That really, you know, shook me and said, okay, just celebrate what your identity is. It made me look at oneself. And it's had huge political impact, his work, on Indian thinkers as well as had Fanon, yeah.
So famous Malcolm X, his father was a Garveyite. His mother was from Guyana. Yeah. And he listened to Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, who said, don't take the kinks out of your hair, take them out of your head.
Mm. Brilliant.
So, Clementine, have you ever thought of straightening your hair?
Well, I didn't just think about it.
Oh.
No.
Revelation.
Absolutely. We've never talked about this, have we?
No.
Well, everybody has a hair story.
But I know that you are very fond of this photograph. Can you tell us why you're so fond of it and where you would have seen it? And where you would have placed it?
This photograph has been tucked away at the entrance hall in my apartment for the last 15 years. Every time I go to answer the door to somebody who's delivering a parcel to another apartment, so it's not my parcel, I look at Malcolm. And so I say hello. Hello, brother. Mm-hmm. And why did I pick it up? I think part of it is vanity, but part of it is actually quite serious. He was born in 1924, if I'm not mistaken.
25,
yeah.
My father was born in 1920.
Wow.
And my father had those glasses, right? And so there is something about this, the presence of this black man in the world. Because at the time, I grew up, I was socialized in Cameroon, which is in West Africa. And my father went to the United Nations in the 60s as part of the independence process of Cameroon. And at the time, it was still segregated. And I know that he deeply, for that reason, he was actually deeply wounded by his experience in America. And Malcolm, I did not really encounter Malcolm X as a person until I came to university in Glasgow. This is when really I drew upon the idea of the black presence, the black body moving through space in majority white society. And Malcolm, he was an absolutely good-looking and well-presented black man. And I was fascinated with him, actually. And the hair story is literally the hair falling out of my scalp at age 12 when I decided, as a bridesmaid, I could not go to a wedding with my hair in its natural kinky state. And so I went to have it straightened, and it fell out of my scalp. The pain of that experience. And the idea that he, as a man, shared that experience with me, you know? And he was a strong black man. He was very intelligent. So I didn't feel as stupid as as I would have had he not shared this intimate, vulnerable moment, which was also a political moment for him, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, so you're referring to the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is co-written, wasn't it, with Alex Haley in the years before his death. Mm-hmm. I've spoken about Malcolm being a kind of man of the pulpit, and you have the kind of thoughts emerge from the pulpit of his mind. But what would you say, Eka, was the voice of Malcolm X?
Wow, this is the thing. So his father was a preacher. Mm-hmm. He is a preacher. He spends 12 years as the spokesperson for the Nation of Islam, and a lot of that time he is in a pulpit. Mm-hmm. He's at Mosque Number One, which is in up in Harlem, and he's in Chicago. He's preaching. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about Malcolm, I think, voice-wise, is his ability to speak across vernaculars. Mm-hmm. So he can take a pulpit and he can tell you about the Bible, he can tell you about the Quran and so on, but he speaks for the street mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And then he speaks with this incredible assurance. He's an autodidact, mm-hmm. so he spends how many years in prison? Yeah. And he reads and he reads and he reads, so he's very well-read. So he can quote from this, he can quote from that, and he can play with words. Mm. The tone, the timbre of his voice, mm. I think, is really interesting. So you see someone who's really in control of their manner, who's able to hold an audience with his words. And so anytime you see a clip of Malcolm X on TV, mm-hmm. that's a segment of him, it's kind of compelling.
Yeah.
Because you rarely see a person so apparently in command of the language and of their physical form simultaneously. Mm. So he's a preacher, a poet, a performer. He's really doing all of this, and he modulates his performance. Mm. So there's a delight. So even while what was he called at one point? You know, the most feared man in America or whatever it was. But he's also most charming and charismatic figure in America at the same time as that. Mm. That was his power.
Yeah. And again, he reminds me of Malcolm X, of Marcus Garvey, who it was famously said, Garvey must have had something. Black people are hell to move. Garvey must have had plenty. Mm. And the same is true of Malcolm X, I think. Mm. Vayu, you're a performer, a storyteller, kind of clear that his presentation is also important to his message, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he's also part of this great, you know, storytelling tradition. I mean, even if you just shifting slightly to Martin Luther King doing his I Have a Dream speech, you see the original footage and there's the call response. It's the audience is never passive. Mm. I'm not suggesting you're passive because you're not passive. That's call response. Oh, yeah. Right? So there's this that would come. So there is a training of a certain mind, possibly with Malcolm, having a very short memory of his father, mm-hmm. you know, being a revolutionary and speaking in those terms. Short sentences which allow this wave of head nod and exclamation or saying, no, that's not true. Call response was so important in these oral traditions. And it's a very strong African tradition, and I know as an Indian, very strong Indian tradition. Mm. We have the aha, oho. That's how we, in India we do it. Mm. I think Bashabi is nodding her head as well. So he has captured that. And then politically, he writes about this. He says, you have to know the social context. You could be telling the old story, but you need to know how are you reaching the people and the circumstance of the moment. Yeah. And he's had, it's interesting, his prison years are really almost like a monastic moment of concentration. You know, he talks about reading and reading and reading. And his brilliance, he joins the something called a debating society. So he knows the capacity of call response. He knows the ability to use the short sentence, which starts in a certain way, the cadence goes up, and it leaves it on a openness for the audience to say, aha, oho, no, or not. Mm-hmm. But he can debate it in the language of those who pose the question. Mm. That's his personal brilliance and his inventiveness. And it's so exciting, even when you're reading it, you know, even as a written form, it's leaping out at you. And he was not somebody who did not use his prison years.
Yes.
You know, the rage is put in.
So, Clementine, when I was growing up, you were either a Malcolm man or you're a Martin man. I was more for the Martin man because Malcolm seemed a bit scary. There was a conflict, wasn't there, between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, because there was no unity. You think about the civil rights being a moment where all black people come together, but no, they had different ideas about how to proceed. And there wasn't, there seems to be, I wonder whether you can speak to this, an enmity between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And I should explain that Clementine's also very good at and specializes in conflict resolution. what would you propose to Martin and Malcolm to resolve their differences?
Well, you see, the first principle of conflict resolution is to regard the other side not as an opposite to be changed or convinced, but as a partner in a conversation where, even if they're extremely polarized, and I don't actually believe that these two men were polarized.
But hold on, Malcolm X did call Martin Luther King an Uncle Tom.
Yes, yeah. He called him that repeatedly.
Yes,
actually,
that's not a nice phrase, is it?
Well, you know, this is a person who believed in naming the difficult thing, and yeah. I think that this is the thing. One of the things he did say to Martin Luther King when he finally met him, he said, "Now you're in trouble," he said, and it was not too shortly after that he was shot, and then King was. Yeah. And the thing I always say when people pose this, which I think is an artificial conflict, I say they both died the same way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that the and King's daughter has said repeatedly that the reason her father is idolized is because the aspect of him which is idolized is the aspect that accepts violence towards the person, which Malcolm X, this is the assurance that Malcolm X gives to many people, is you are absolutely allowed to defend yourself. If you are attacked violently in a context, and we have to remember his history, his father being murdered, his mother being driven into a state of mental illness, and then them being taken away from her instead of her being helped. The idea that Martin Luther King believed in simply submitting your body to violence until you were killed, this was never true. Actually, there is a much more radicalized version of Martin Luther King, which people simply don't want to remember because, of course, there is the idea that peace comes through justice, right? And there is the idea that actually peace can be in the way of justice. And I think they were on the same page about that. But I just think Malcolm was very, very uncomfortable to have. But he said, in his own words, he said, before he came along, people thought the NAACP was radical. Okay. Well, they ran into the arms of Martin Luther King after he started to... Think about one of the things that he said really clearly, is he said, don't send students down to Alabama. After these four white civil rights activists were kidnapped and murdered in Alabama, he sent a message to the president of the KKK chapter there to say that he would come with his people.
This is Malcolm X.
This is Malcolm X. He said, we will work with King in this way. We will prevent violence towards these young people who are out there trying to campaign. So you see, he was proposing that they actually work together.
Thank you. I should point out that this is going to blow your minds. Uncle Tom was no Uncle Tom. Have a think about that. On the cover of the autobiography, I can explain later if you want to tap me on the shoulder, in the green room or around the roundabouts. On the cover of the autobiography of Malcolm X, there's a quote from him. When I am dead, I say, because from the things I know, I do not expect to live long enough to read this book in its finished form. I want you to watch and see if I'm right, if I'm not right in what I say, that the white man in his press is going to identify me with hate. That did come to pass, didn't it, Echo? And was he a man of hate? would you say?
I mean, he was a man of many different impulses, emotions and beliefs, and those shifted across the course of his life. It's interesting because he used anger. He spoke of anger. He spoke of retribution. He spoke of righteous vengeance, all of these things. And at the same time, he wasn't content with remaining simply there. It's interesting, you know, he comes in reaction somewhat to Martin Luther King and the kind of nonviolence movement. But he's trying to work stuff out. He knows he can't subsist entirely on anger. That can't satisfy him. Ultimately, he can't even satisfy his supporters. So he continues looking. So, you know, famously, we can divide his life into these sections. He's on the streets as Detroit Red. He's a young man. He goes to prison, comes out, becomes part of the Nation for 12 years, but then he breaks with the Nation. And the last few years of his life, which I find personally very interesting, he's searching for a new, for a more developed philosophy, because he realizes that everything he knows up until that point is not enough. It's not enough to cope with the complexity or the contradiction of the world around him, the civil rights era, birth of Pan-Africanism, new independence movements in Africa. He's trying to grapple with a larger picture. He's trying to come to a bigger philosophy about the position of black people in a world that's interconnected, historically entwined, historically entangled. And he outgrows the Nation. He outgrows their slightly sophistic approach to politics, to belief. He realizes there's a bigger world. He's learning. He's still angry, but he's trying to understand that within the context of a much greater schema. And he's still on that search. He's still on that journey when he's shot. Arguably, he's shot and killed because he's on that journey.
Vayu, you're a child in the 60s, but what do you think from reading about Malcolm X now that white people in America feared? What did they? Why was he, as Echo said, the most feared man in America, do you think?
I think this, just taking on from what Echo was saying, and it sort of goes within that, why was he feared? Two words come to my mind. One is, strangely, nonviolence, and the other one is the transformation. It's very, so when one sees the icon of Malcolm X, all the time it's being perceived as a man of who's speaking about racism. He doesn't mince his words, and they clothe it that it's hatred. No, it's rage. And the you see, even, okay, I'm going to say something which is possibly going to be difficult to digest. Mahatma Gandhi is associated with peace, nonviolence, ahimsa. But even to get to that point of nonviolence, so much violence had to take place. Why does the violence take place? It's because the oppressor, whatever color it is, whatever faith it is not understanding what that struggle is. The struggle is for equality. And that's what Malcolm X is doing. And you need that anger. You need that rage. The other word I'm using is transformation. And that's what happens. In a way, thanks to my husband, who was doing some research, and we were listening to the World Service broadcast of his letter, which his daughter has collected. Her name is, I think, Dr. Elijah Abbas, I think. And so she's done this broadcast about his, what happened in that transformation at the Hajj, where he has, to follow on with what you said, he's actually found himself. Now he's beyond the institution, beyond the Nation. And don't you think that is something that the whole of America will fear? Because a man out of the grid lines has found himself. And this is the real call that's going to move. It's going to make it a movement.
I think you're right. And I think they also feared his fearlessness. He didn't really care whether he was going to perish. He knew he lived with that fear of assassination, or that knowledge of his assassination, for quite a few years. What strikes me, I wonder whether you can speak to this, Clementine, is we all hold on to certain narratives in our lives or certain beliefs, and we'll fight tooth and claw to hold on to them. Someone like Malcolm X goes through this amazing transformation, which Vahi was alerted to. He transforms himself from one dogmatic person to another. And that's, I think, part of his attraction for me. Is it for you as well?
Absolutely.
Can you speak more to that?
So you have a young boy who goes through one of the most difficult childhoods you can imagine. And if you really look back at his family history, you will see that his parents were also very stubborn people. These are people who were missold a house in a white neighborhood, were asked to move out of that house, and absolutely refused until they were burnt out of the house, right? So his father being a Garveyite, that is one very strict set of dogmas to live by. His father being a preacher, that's a rigid structure. And then you have this, the transformation which you've both described. So I'm not going to go back through that. But if you even listen to Malcolm X's speeches, and I've listened to his speeches in the original, you can hear him thinking. He's responding, but he's not responding with an answer which he prepared and he just gives you a speech. He's actually responding live, he's engaging with what's coming at him. So you can see that this is a person who is trained in fluidity somehow. And the latter period of his life, I think one of the things that struck me the most about him is that he really believed in what he was doing. So when he was in the Nation of Islam, which I think I regard it as a cult, actually, he was able to realize after being in this organization for 12 years and arriving at the peak, really, of performance in this organization, when he broke with the Nation of Islam, he broke with the Nation of Islam because of the leader's sexual misconduct with his teenage secretaries. Now, we have a real problem of sexual violence today. And we have politicians and leaders of organizations, companies, who are not able to break with the heads of these organizations when these people... This behavior degrades other human beings. And I'm very proud of Malcolm X, that this was the point of principle on which he broke with the NOI. So this is a big thing. It's a big personal risk to take for the most vulnerable people in the organization. He was disgusted and offended and ready to lose his life over it. And he effectively did. And I think this is highly significant when we talk about this man being a man of hate and a man of fear, because he was neither. He was a man of principle, and his own life was not more important to him than the principles which he supported. That's a big change. To have an organization which is called the Organization of Afro-American Unity, to become an internationalist, to go and travel for 5 months through Africa, to go to Mecca, to come back and say, I was wrong. I was just plain wrong. It was wrong to say that white people were the devil. It was wrong to say that there was no way of working together. He actually was talking about internationalist solidarity between people, not really on the basis of extreme nationalism, but on the basis of justice for people who were much wider than just black people. He talked about people in Vietnam, because I think it was the Vietnam War that was going on at the time. I think that's incredible fluidity, incredible power to grow as a human being, and it is sorely lacking in the leadership that we have today.
Thank you. We're going to ask Eka to read from his book, The Strangers, which is extracted in this magazine. But before we do, there was an image that flashed up of Muhammad Ali, and one of the more poignant, well, there are lots of poignant moments in your book, is when you talk about the impact of that on Malcolm X. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, they became very close at the time when Muhammad Ali was becoming a supporter of the Nation of Islam, Cassius Clay. For a year, he'd started
kind of been involved in the nation, hadn't changed his name publicly. Malcolm became a kind of counselor to him. Muhammad Ali referred to him as his big brother. Malcolm X talked about him as his little brother. So they became very close for a while. And then when Malcolm broke with the nation, Muhammad Ali stayed with the nation. And it was, for Malcolm, it was devastating, yeah. Really. Yeah. They had a real kind of closeness. And so in The Strangers, there's a chapter in The Strangers about Malcolm X. Chiefly, it takes place in Ghana in 1964, where after Malcolm goes to Mecca, he carries on moving through Africa, and he goes to Ghana for a week to meet Kwame Nkrumah, who's the Pan-Africanist leader of Ghana. Ghana's the first independent country in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a kind of beacon for Pan-Africanism, and he goes there, and he actually has an incredible week in Ghana. He's kind of feted internationally. But in his last day, as Malcolm is leaving to go to the airport, who should be arriving in the same hotel but Muhammad Ali? And they meet. Malcolm hears this voice that's familiar coming out of the hotel as Malcolm is leaving. It's Muhammad Ali surrounded by an entourage, his brother, all these people, his kind of hangers-on, his kind of fellow, because he's world champion by this point. Malcolm hails Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali looks through him. He doesn't acknowledge him. And he says something out loud about who's that old has-been over there? Who's that old man over there? And he walks past him derisively. Yeah. And it's a devastating moment for Malcolm because the risks he's taken in leaving the nation have also meant leaving behind some of these people who were closest to him. And that moment, which should have been, could have been, this height of here they both are in Africa, in a free state in Africa, it turns into the most bitter of moments. And actually, years later, Muhammad Ali is asked about if he has regrets in his life, and he cites this moment as one of the moments of his biggest regrets in his life. But a year after that, Malcolm X is shot dead, yeah. And it's too late to reconcile.
And just a little while before he's assassinated, he comes to Britain, doesn't he? Would you read us, a minute or two from the...
Yeah. Yeah, so curiously, in fact, so after all of this, so he goes to Mecca, he goes to Ghana and other countries. Malcolm X comes to Britain, he comes to Birmingham. Mm-hmm. He is invited initially to give a talk at the Oxford Union or in Cambridge or something, but he spends a day going to Smethwick in Birmingham, which has been the site of racial antagonism. So Malcolm is invited to Smethwick for the day to kind of survey the scene there.
Yeah.
I tell you what, stop me when, because okay. It's only a couple of things, but you've got a sense of time.
I've got the power, yeah. Go.
Yeah, yeah. So just otherwise, you know, it's only short, but okay. I also want to respect. Sure. We're in a flow. So good. I don't want to, you know.
Good.
Okay. All right. Smethwick, England, 12th February 1965. From the train station, you walk down cobble streets past a tired-looking pub and a giant bingo hall to meet Avtar Singh Johal, the energetic leader of the Indian Workers Association, a local group campaigning against an anti-immigrant fervour that's taken hold of Smethwick. Johal leads you through the town, his breath forming steaming clouds in the cold air, as he describes how burgeoning job opportunities in Smethwick's factories and car plants drew thousands of young men from India and the Caribbean, and how, in turn, they received a harsh welcome from locals. In the town which was once the constituency of Oswald Mosley, landlords wouldn't rent to them, said Johal. Pubs wouldn't serve them. In the factories, they were given the dirtiest and most dangerous jobs. You arrive at a hectic scene in Smethwick. A mass of newspaper reporters and a BBC TV crew are clustered in the road, waiting to interview you. On the pavement beside them, a clutch of white residents, mostly women in housecoats, look on, arms folded, muttering skeptically among themselves. Griffiths, the MP who won his seat with the slogan, "If you want a nigger for a neighbour, vote Labour." is also here. He's already talking to the press from amongst a group of aides, his finger indignantly stabbing the air. It makes my blood boil that Malcolm X should be allowed into this country, he's saying. A whole news gathering side of the English world is trying to turn Smethwick into something it's not. This is Birmingham, England, not Birmingham, Alabama. All your life you've known these men, who think their whiteness gives them the right to deny coloured people their respect as a human being. He's no different from the men who killed your father, or the judge who inflated your prison sentence for having a white girlfriend. The worst form of human being is one who judges another human by the colour of their skin, you say to the reporters. And as you speak, Griffiths looks on from the side, seething. He tries to interject, but you raise your voice and carry on speaking. Britain has a colour problem, and people like him would rather object to your presence than address the real issues at hand. From what you've seen today, the situation in Smethwick is as bad as it is back home. Coloured people here are being treated in the same way as the Negroes are treated in Alabama, and all they want is to be respected for their humanity.
Thank you. Thanks, Echo.
Beautifully read.
So, what do you think Malcolm X would make of the moment we are in now, Vayu? What would he have to say? Do you think he'd have powerful things to say that would help us through this period?
I think he really went through that trajectory and that arc, and interestingly, he would have responded to the conflict. He would not have shied away from hammering the truth out, calling a spade a spade eloquently. But he would have resolved conflict, because within himself and his spirit and the journey he took, he had found something called harmony. Mm-hmm. Whether, you know, I think that moment from the Hajj or his, whichever faith he may have taken on, I think that transformation moment was there. He had to find that in himself, mm-hmm. and finding that sense of equanimity, but seeing it active mm-hmm. at within that pilgrimage. Because what is a pilgrimage? You're going through these different stages, and at each stage, whether it's the Stations of the Cross, whether it's taking a yatra, whether it's going to the Hajj, at each stage of the crossing, something is changing in you. Mm-hmm. And that's changed in him. So when he's turning around, he's seeing that actually blonde, blue-eyed, brown, Jewish, black, colored, African, any Indian Muslims, there is a level of equality where they can be equal with that sense of justice. And what he's trying to do when he's coming back is that he wants to do that, explore that experiment, if you like, in America, that it is possible. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the stages of the pilgrimage. So, okay, that's living in his time. Why I think he would be have been amazing living in our time is because he was a man who always understood the context. He understood poverty, he understood circumstances, and so he spoke with that heartbeat of the social context of the moment. That's his incredible.
Thanks, Faye. Finally, Clementine, do you get a sense, as I do, that actually one of his powers was that he's also very, very amusing?
Oh, my goodness. I'm glad you've said that. Yeah. You see, because he said a lot of difficult things, he has this reputation, but my goodness, he was a funny, funny guy,
yeah.
right? And I think that these people are really dangerous for their wit, because he could take people... I mean, the best and the most feared comedians, the talent of comedy, when you start to work a room, you see people start to look away from you. Because I've heard that part of the reason why our body has this reaction to something I said on stage is we're actually afraid. And when we laugh out of relief, right? Yeah. He really was. I think that it is the intelligence, really, of the man, and also what you describe is somebody who is really big. Mm. This is a very big, expansive personality. Mm. So he's able to take a zoomed out position and he's able to choose really how he's going to respond to every situation. And if you hear him speak, he rhymes mm-hmm. as well, right? Mm. So very often the things he say rhythmically mm. are actually also quite comical. Mm. Yeah. I don't know what else to say apart from just to agree with you. Mm. If you, he has good.
It's always
jokes.
Good to agree with me, by the way. good taste. And he's, funnily enough, he's also very intimidating, but he's actually very accommodating. Mm. And the story of Malcolm X being on in the audience when James Baldwin's speaking, and James Baldwin looks down and he's so terrified as about what he might say that might be critiqued by Malcolm X. Later, he really wanted to be someone who is admired. That's the other thing about him. Is that he's the sort of person you want to get him on your side. Mm. Would you agree, Echo?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. Because you don't want him not on your side. Right, yeah. But at the same time, yeah, you're completely... Clementine, you're completely right. It's a pleasure in life. Like, he, on a personal level, he's very abstemious. You know, doesn't drink, doesn't do this, doesn't do that. It's very kind of monastic almost, or married, children. But, yeah... The pleasure of speaking and the pleasure of being in company. Mm-hmm. This is the thing. Like, there's a conviviality. There's a reason he's in the Nation. Yeah, because it gives him a family. Yeah. Do you know, a larger family. Mm. And you can see that when you listen to him. He's playing with the words, but he's also, the connection he's trying to establish everyone around him. That's who he was.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to end. So I'd like to thank Clementine Burnley.
Thank you.
Vayu Naidu. Echo Ashun.
And Colin Grant.